You're listening to the Story of Woman podcast with Lindsay Hansen Park.
About the third stop from where I boarded the bus, there were some white people got on, and they took all the front seats.
To those waiting with bated breath for that favorite media catchphrase, the U-turn, I have only one thing to say. U-turn if you want to. The ladies, not a turn.
It is a violation of human rights when babies are denied food or drowned or suffocated or their spines broken simply because they are born girls.
I'm feeling honored that I'm being chosen to the Nobel Peace Prize.
If you are a black person and live in the black community and walk out on the street every day seeing white policemen surrounding you, and then you ask me whether I approve of violence, I mean, that just doesn't make any sense at all.
The Foreign Secretary about sexual violence and conflict, and Kashmir was not mentioned once. And this is a disgrace, and we consider Kashmir was ignored.
She's gonna learn that this life will hit you hard in the face, wait for you to get back up just so it can kick you in the stomach. But getting the wind knocked out of you is the only way to remind your lungs how much they like the taste of air.
I have a new word for you. It's called abiogenesis. Say it out loud, abiogenesis. Don't think I didn't have to look this up to see how it was pronounced. But abiogenesis is the natural process of life arising from non-living matter. So how did something dead, something non-living, something never living, turn into something living? How did organic material form out of something like rock? Abiogenesis. This abiogenesis, where life sort of popped up from nothing, has caused so much controversy in the human condition, right? People have fought wars over where we think that life came from. Religions have what they believe is the genesis of human life. There are mythological stories all across the board of the creation of life, and we'll talk about those more as we get into this series. But from a biological and geophysical standpoint, this abiogenesis occurred somewhere between 3.8 and 4 billion years ago. Again, if we're looking at the beginning of woman, we're looking at about 4 billion years ago when life first started, at least life as we know and understand it. The study of abiogenesis really takes three things into consideration: geophysical, chemical, and biological. And more and more and more scientists are trying to synthesize all three fields of study. Now, you're going to have to stick with us today on this episode. It's going to be really egg-heady. Lots of stuff to talk about. We're going to cover about 40 to 50 fields of study to cover one concept, and that concept is how we developed from single-celled animals into people. Super complicated, really complex. People will study their whole lifetime on just little areas of this. So we're going to go really fast. Now, growing up, if you're like me, most of us were taught that life could be divided into about two things. You had your plant life and you had your animal life. And there was little talk of things in between, things like microorganisms. I had heard the word amoeba before, and in my mind, I see this little jellyfish-like thing floating around on a black screen. That's about all I knew about amoebas. And I had learned about fungus, but it was something I didn't like to think about because fungus sounded disgusting. It was something that grew in the locker room on the cute and sweaty boys in the wrestling team. It also was something that we ate on pizza, so fungus was something I didn't want to think about. We often ignore these important processes that caused us. Maybe it's too heady to think about. Maybe it's too boring. Maybe we don't understand it. It's complex. What we do need to understand, though, is multi-celled organisms, like us, with lots and lots of cells, somehow developed out of single cells. We gained sensory perception. We developed predatory features and prey-like features. And we turned from little tiny amoeba-like creatures into mammals. How did that happen? Well, if you grew up Christian like me, you believe God created the world and organized matter through this mysterious sort of way. But there are other ways of thinking about this organization, this matter. All of us, we start with one thing, a single cell. The first cell, picture it in your mind, this round little tiny cell, it divides and divides and divides again. One cell divides into two, two into four, four into eight. And inside every single little cell is a copy of a complete genetic code that becomes the recipe, the instruction manual for your body. It tells your body what to do. In each cell is an instruction manual. It tells it what to grow and how to grow and how things should function. It lets you feel pleasure and pain and think and sleep. It gives you the ability to breathe air into your lungs and to hear my voice right now. It remembers to make you hungry. And it helps remember to extract nutrients when you eat and helps the food digest in your body. Cells do all of that. The genetic codes in your cells tell your body how to do all of that. You sitting there, I want you to look at your body and feel it. You're made of trillions of cells. Trillions. Hold up your hand. There are about 2.5 billion cells in just one of your hands. But they're so tiny. So tiny that you can't see them. You can see your hand, which is this end result of 2.5 billion cells. If every cell in your hand was the size of a grain of sand, like on the ocean, your hand would be the size of a school bus. But how does each cell know what job to do? How does human bodies know what job it has to do? Who tells a human being what to do? Just like we're told what to do if we go to a job, our cells are also told what to do. They're told what to do by something you've all heard of, a very special molecule called DNA. DNA is the chemical inside the nucleus cells, and it carries the genetic instructions for making living organisms. So a DNA molecule consists of about two strands that wrap around each other to resemble a twisted ladder. I like to think of braiding my hair in a French twist. That's kind of what a strand of DNA looks like. Except instead of being made out of hair, the sides are made out of sugar and phosphate molecules. And we know a lot about DNA thanks to the people like Rosalind Franklin. Franklin was an English chemist and X-ray crystallographer, and she made contributions to understanding fine molecular structures of DNA. She did a lot of work with coal and viruses, and they were appreciated in her time, but her greatest impact was probably its impact on the study of DNA. She was born into a prominent Jewish family and educated at a private school in Norland Place in West London. She excelled in all that she did, in all the major subjects and at sports. She passed her matriculation at age 18 and won the school living exhibition of 30 pounds a year for 3 years. When she won, her father asked her to donate the money she earned to refugee students during World War II, and she did. She then went on to study science at Cambridge, and she joined the University of Cambridge Physical Chemistry Laboratory. At first, it was really rough for her. In fact, it would always be really rough for her. She was very quiet and shy. She kept to herself. She was athletic, but she didn't like to wear a lot of makeup or dress nicely. She was described as agnostic, which, you know, right after the war was a hard thing to be. Her lack of religious faith did not stem from any sort of influence, just from her own thinking and her own inquisitive mind. It's said that she developed skepticism as a child. Her mother once said that she refused to believe in the existence of God, and later remarked as a child, quote, "Well, anyhow, how do you know he isn't a she?" She later made her position clear, now based on her scientific experience, and wrote to her father in 1940, quote, "Science and everyday life cannot and should not be separated. Science for me gives a partial explanation of life. I do not accept your definition of faith. For example, the belief in life after death. Your faith rests on the future of yourself and others as individuals. Mine in the future of fate of our successors. It seems to be that yours is the more selfish. As to the question of a creator of what? I see no reason to believe that the creator of protoplasm or primeval matter, if such there be, has any reason to be interested in our insignificant race in a tiny corner of the universe, in spite of her challenges, in our tiny corner of the universe." Rosalind Franklin had a hard time fitting in, naturally because of her skepticism and her inability to conform to standards. But in spite of her challenges, we can thank Franklin for a lot of what we know about DNA. She was discriminated against a lot in the field of science. James Watson, one of her colleagues, wrote in the Double Helix that Franklin was unreasonable and emotional and uncooperative. He said, quote, "She was not unattractive and might have been quite stunning had she taken even a mild interest in clothes. He was bothered that she didn't wear lipstick to work. Women in academia in the 1950s were treated with institutionalized discrimination, and her close colleague Frances Crick remarked, quote, "I'm afraid we always used to adopt, let's say, a patronizing attitude towards her," end quote. In spite of all of the challenges, Franklin came up with some of the best images in existence of the possible structure of DNA. She achieved this by means of X-ray crystallography. Four researchers, including Franklin, basically pioneered what we know about DNA today. Her work, of course, was used without her permission by some of the researchers. It caused some controversy, and she died before being awarded the Nobel Prize like some of her colleagues. It's women like Franklin who were there on the front lines of science, pioneering what we know about our single cells and what's inside of them and what tells them to act. So how did we get from single cells to multicells? Not only did single-celled organisms take the evolutionary leap into multicellular life, they did it more than once. The transition from single-cell to multi-cell organisms has only happened a handful of times, though, but the consequences for life on Earth have been immense. With just these handful of times when single cells have developed into multi-cells, evolution produced all of the plants and animals that thrive today. And they're species that we're still finding out today, so this is an incredible thing. I have interviewed a professor and biologist at Boise State University, Dr. Crystal Scott, and she is going to explain some of these processes to us, including how genes develop sex selection. Crystal, welcome back. We had you on last episode. Will you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. I'm a scientist. I currently run the Biomolecular Research Center at Boise State University. I am a trained embryologist. That means I look at embryos and how the cells of an embryo form a being. I particularly work with Xenopus laevis, and currently I'm working in molecular biology. My passion in life right now is bacteriophage, viruses that infect bacteria.
Okay, so we talked a little bit about this to sort of set it up for this episode, but will you explain to us what sex selection is?
Sure. Sex selection is a very complex process, and this complex process allows for mating to take place between individuals. A lot of times the investment for mating is much higher for the female than it is for the male, and this goes across many, many, many different species. So you start having sex selection when you have a non-asexual organism.
Okay, so in feminist theory, we often talk about gender roles and gender performance. What does that mean for sex selection?
Okay. So a lot of this is not intentional. It's not learned behavior. It's natural behavior that occurs with no training. It is behavior that occurs that is biologically incorporated into the organism.
So would you say that female and male have biologically ingrained behaviors?
They sure do. And it depends on the organism, but absolutely there are complex behaviors that take place between male and female. And for us primates, higher primates, it's harder to tease those parts kind of away from each other because we have been so trained by civilization and society that those lines get a little bit blurred.
What does it mean from a biological standpoint for people that might be on the spectrum of genders that might have both characteristics of male and female?
Oh my gosh. So that is one thing that exists, and probably humans, we know more about that continuum than anything else. So there are people who exist right in the middle with both anatomical parts for male and female, but they also exhibit typical male and female behavior. But it's a continuum from extremely male presentation and behavior to extremely female presentation and behavior. But there is it truly is a spectrum from one end to the other. People fall somewhere along that spectrum.
And we know a lot of this is culture, right? Like you said, performance, but biology plays, how does that work in biology?
In biology, particularly with animals, you can see this as well. And it is something that exists. It is something that is ingrained, and it is something that is untainted by society or culture. So to see, I remember the first time I saw two male frogs amplexing or mating with each other, I was just blown away. But you can see it in nature as well.
Interesting. So almost across the board, this sort of spectrum happens.
It does. And so for me, as a 22-year-old coming from Kansas, I had no idea that homosexuality was a real thing. I thought it was just something that was made up, like an urban myth. And the more I learned about organisms, fruit flies exhibit homosexual behavior if they have mutations in certain genes. And then one day I walk into the frog room and look into the male frog tank because we kept all our males together. And I saw that. I was like, whoa, this is insane. I had no idea that this existed. And it does, and you can see it happening.
Okay, so if you have inherent female characteristics and male characteristics that are just part of biology, is that also a spectrum as well then?
Yeah. So we have this thing going on right now because there are a lot of estrogens in the environment. We can talk about that later. You have genetically male birds and frogs that present as female, and they also present as female in terms of behavior as well, but they are genetically male. However, they are sterile, so that's why we're seeing certain species dying out right now.
Oh, that's fascinating.
It really is. Look, environmental estrogens, you should look it up.
Okay, and maybe we can link to that, but tell me, what are, just off the top of your head for primates, what are some inherent characteristics that are hardline female characteristics versus hardline male?
Okay. Female characteristics, maternal instinct. Mothers will fight to the death for their young. Female primates particularly will act less, what's the word? They will be submissive to males. Females often develop close friendships, particularly in the primate world, with other females. And females will help each other raise their young. Those are some general characteristics.
And do we know that those are biologically produced, or is society part of this and culture part of this behavior?
Yeah, that's a great question. So it seems to be biological, but in these group sort of situations with primates particularly, society definitely plays a role in it. And there are some really heartbreaking studies about baby primates that are taken away from their mothers and experimented with if they are not given a mother monkey or something to stand in the place of a mother monkey. They develop some pretty serious behavioral problems that mimic actually autism.
Interesting. Okay, well, before I let you go, one more question. Can you define for us, just from a scientific perspective, the difference between biology and culture?
Sure. Biology is ingrained. It is in your DNA. And we like to say DNA makes RNA makes protein, and protein gives you function, and protein gives you phenotype. And phenotype can be behavior. It can be a physical characteristic. Culture is going to be learned behaviors that are acceptable or non-acceptable that allow you to either fit in or stand out of your culture.
Great. Well, thanks again for coming on.
Sure. Thank you. I love it.
Let's dig into a little bit more about what Dr. Scott was talking about. The first organisms to utilize oxygen existed around 2,400,000,000 years ago in what is referred to as the Great Oxygenation Event. This is a big deal, even though it's so far away and it sounds like something really boring and old. But this is the first time anaerobic forms of life started to be wiped out by oxygen consumers. By 12 million years ago, sexual reproduction evolves, leading to faster evolution. And this is what Dr. Scott was talking about. Sex and its central role in biology is the main reason why men and women are different. But like Dr. Scott said, it's really hard to tease biology apart from culture. We hope to do that a lot more in this podcast. Anatomical differences are obviously biological. While if you look at any human society, it's easy enough to see that the differences between men and women are liable to change, right? Sometimes people will say, oh, women are more feminine and soft and they like fancier clothes and they like to spend a lot of time on their appearance. Well, if you look at like 18th century France, men in those times certainly changed places with women with those roles. They were soft, they wore powdered wigs, they wore high heels, they wore fancy clothing. You just can't, it's really tricky when you want to say men do this and women do this. There are distinctions between male and female. It's one of the oldest facts in biology, except for bacteria. Nearly all life produces sexually at some time or another. And two distinct sexes are generally necessary to do this. We know a lot about how sexes come to be from an unlikely source, vulvaceae algae. Studying vulvaceae green algae is like studying a time machine. In a relatively short amount of time, only 200 million years, the algae evolves from a free-living, single-celled ancestor into a variety of multicellular life forms. This is how we get what we call sexual dimorphism. And it's possible to study in vulvaceae algae because they encompass an entire range of reproductive morphologies, from isogamy to oogamy. The algae can be found in existing cells, duos, in small clusters, all the way up into big, huge groups of 50,000 clusters. And as the groups of algae get larger, some cells give up their functions, like we talked about in the last episode. Some of them put all of their energy into one single cell. In a small group of these cells, if one is better at gathering the food than, say, another one, and the other won't have to work as hard at getting food, and they put the energy into this movement to help the food be gathered more easily. Tiny mutations produce cells that are better at things. So some cells might start to evolve to be better at reproduction. Some might be better at movement. Some might be better at food gathering. Some might be better at self-protection. And these cells could not survive on their own, and they need all of these other cells to help them. So they gather in groups. They start collecting. And they do jobs that the others have somehow forgotten how to do. Now, sex reproduction in single cells into multi-cells is a complicated process. It basically involves words that are too hard to say, like Chlamydomonas and Vulvax catarrhi. And these are multicellular relatives of one another. The Vulvax catarrhi, though, has male and female cells, while the Chlamydomonas don't. Comparing the two, the ones without the male and female cells and the ones that do, we learn a lot about how sexes evolve. Chlamydomonas sex is typical for a single-celled sexual organism. It's very primitive. These algae come in two different mating types. They call them a plus and a minus mating type. And instead of issuing specialized male and female reproductive cells, the organism transforms its entire one-celled self into a gamete that seeks out a partner of the opposite mating type. It's kind of like two poles of a magnet. It has a plus and a minus. It finds organisms that are different than it is. And the differences in the cells that do exist are really only there to allow one mating type to recognize and fuse with the other. It's fascinating, but very primitive. Now, the other multicellular organism that's much larger than the Chlamydomonas is the Vulvax. And when the Vulvax has sex, It is surprisingly familiar. This Vulvix algae, made up of about 2,000 cells, exist as very distinct male and female. The males produce sperm that fertilize the eggs of the females, and that produces a little tiny zygote that develops into a cute little algae embryo. Does that sound familiar? Here's what's crazy about this. This whole reproductive process evolved from scratch in algae in the last 200 million years, during a time when reptiles, mammals, amphibians, and all these other sexually reproducing ancestors were roaming the earth. So basically, the Vulvix are an evolutionary rerun of what is happening. Now, one of the biggest, oldest biological differences between the male and female sex is how their reproductive cells function. Once you have sex-specific reproductive cells, new sex-specific evolutionary strategies start to come into play. Maybe we would call these behaviors. These derive from the development of even more physical and behavioral differences between male and female. In the Vulvix, there are about 12 genes that are only found in males or females. In humans, there are about 80 protein coding genes that exist on the Y chromosome that are only specific to men. The human master gene, which is called the SRI, has a primary job to switch genetic program. For example, one of those functions would be to produce sperm. It codes the DNA, it tells the cells what to do, and it produces sperm. That is something that is very male specific. Now, of course, like Dr. Scott talked about, there is a whole spectrum in between distinctly male and distinctly female. Our bodies and nature is really interesting in that there's a whole spectrum of biological instances and exceptions to these rules. This is important to understand just so we can see how the sexes start to form. Male starts to form, the cells start to tell the body how to perform some functions, and some become female and some become male. Now, it's really important when we do this that we don't attribute social and cultural characteristics to this biology. And for years, even scientists did this, and this is what feminist theorists have criticized science for being very male-dominated, for taking the science and interpreting it in a way that made sense to them in their worldview. That perhaps it was biological, that women were softer, were more inferior, were not as strong as men. Forgetting that there is a whole spectrum, or maybe not discovering that there's an entire spectrum in between male and female, and really not doing the work to untangle what truly is a biological function, like producing sperm, versus producing a womb and having a child. So let's back it up. About 900 million years ago, we see the coelflagellates, which become, I guess, our very first ancestors to the entire animal kingdom. So remember, about 4 billion years ago, we have life start to form. By about 900 million years ago, we have the first multicelled organisms that start to look similar to all of what we know about the entire animal kingdom. There's a theory that they might be direct ancestors of sponges. Proterospongia, which are members of the coenoflagellata, are the best examples of when the ancestors of animals might have looked like. They live in colonies, and they show this very primitive level of cellular specialization for tasks. Very primitive. Animal cells are different than other cells, than, say, bacteria cells. Millions of years ago, elements on the bottoms of lakes and ponds began to react to each other. And we talked about this in the first episode. The earth was moving, right? It was always moving. Things were moving, and this movement is what created life. Things in these ponds started reacting to each other. They formed bonds, and then they would break bonds, and they would replicate these bonds over and over and over. This is what they were doing. The cells were coding, telling to do one function, and these functions would bump up against and crash into each other. Eventually, a random string of elements learned to duplicate itself and then divide into two, and then both halves duplicate themselves and so on. And this reaction spread across the floor of the pond, with each new generation of molecules generating abnormalities from the last. These little strings of organic material start to get longer, and they start to grow. And with each new generation, And then millions and millions of generation and millions of mutations later, these strings eventually develop a protective layer. This is what we now call the cell wall. But the cell wall would eventually allow this organism to protect itself against materials that would keep it from duplicating. Sometimes smaller cells might get stuck inside the bigger cells. If their processes proved helpful to the larger cell, a symbiotic relationship would form and both would thrive. If the smaller cell's processes were harmful, both would die. I guess this is what Darwin would call survival of the fittest. Evolution occurs when the offspring of a cell has a slight mutation. Now, generally speaking, mutated cells die quickly. Rarely a mutated cell can live alongside cells without the mutation. And even rarer still, the mutated cell will outperform the parent cells and duplicate to make even more outperforming cells, eventually replacing the parent cells altogether. Very, very, very rarely a mutation would give an organism a distinct advantage, like light perception. It only took the single mutation of a protein molecule in a single-celled bacteria to make one cell light sensitive. Advantages of even slight light sensitivity were things like avoiding the brightest, most burning light and being able to easily find light to use as food. So this mutation actually was an advantage. One tiny little cell became resistant to light. This was a good thing. It protected it from extreme heat. It could use the energy from the light by finding it. Light-sensitive proteins are passed down from a genetic line. Mutations continue to occur at random, with beneficial mutations giving a slightly better life expectancy. And therefore, you get a better chance at passing on that mutation. I actually heard a scientist describe mutation to me as God, that their faith in God, the Creator, was in mutations. Mutations happening at random, passing this down to someone. That the creation is in the mutation. An example of a modern-day mutation in humans is the ability to drink milk. Random mutations thousands of years ago gave humans the ability to digest lactose. We didn't always have that ability. That small mutation gave humans the ability to find more nutrients. Now, these mutations eventually led, after millions of years, to creatures getting out of the water and onto the land. Now remember, the land was very formidable. It was extremely hot. It was bathed in intense ultraviolet radiation and very, very dry. If something were to live on land, that something would have to undergo entire revisions to their anatomies. The biggest factor in moving a water-dwelling creature onto the land is the temperature difference. While ocean water has a relatively constant temperature, the temperature of air on dry land can change drastically and rather quickly. We know that plants began the process of this colonization into land 450 million years ago, and they were accompanied by tiny mites and other microscopic organisms that were needed to help break them down and reduce them into dead organic matter. The first organisms to crawl out of the water and survive were ones that had evolved to naturally higher body temperatures. So somewhere along the line, a little cell in the water could handle higher heat, could handle getting more fluctuation in body temperatures. Some species evolved a naturally higher body temperature, allowing them to spend more time on land to search for food, and others maintained a low body temperature and evolved into today's reptiles. Cold-blooded animals needed less food to survive, but they rely on external heat sources like the sun to fuel bursts of energy. Both warm-blooded mammals and cold-blooded reptiles have taken the same evolutionary challenge of surviving in the fluctuating temperatures. At about 580 million years ago, we start to see the existence of multicellular animal movement, which may have started with the cnidarians. Almost all cnidarians possess nerves and muscles. Because they are the simplest animals to possess them, their direct ancestors were probably the first animals to use nerves and muscles together. Cnidarians are also the first animals with an actual body of definite form and shape. they have radial symmetry, if you were to look at them. And this is where we believe the first eyes evolved at this time. After them, flatworms show up rather quickly. Now, flatworms are the earliest animals to have a brain, and they are the simplest animals to have a bilateral symmetry. They are also the simplest animals that we know of with organs that form three germ layers. Now, a lot of these animals start to be recorded in the fossil record during the Cambrian explosion. So flatworms are one of them. They show up about 550 million years ago. Then 10 million years later from the flatworms, we have acorn worms that have evolved. And they're considered more highly specialized and advanced than other similarly shaped worm-like creatures. They have a circulatory system and a heart, and their heart actually functions as a kidney. Acorn worms have a gill-like structure that's used for breathing, a structure that is said to be similar to primitive fish. And so, because of this, acorn worms are sometimes linked between vertebrates and invertebrates. 40 million years later, from the acorn worms, we see the first vertebrates appear. Now remember, this is going rather quickly, but from 10 million years to 40 million years, we have vertebrates start to appear. The ostracoderms were jawless fish related to the present-day lampreys and hagfishes. And they were jawless, and their internal skeletons were cartilaginous. They lacked fins like modern-day fish. And if we fast forward several hundred million years, we see the first tetrapods. This is where we see the first reptiles, the first animal with limbs start to form. So are you getting the picture? Single cells group and divide and group and divide, and some little mutation gets in there that either kills the organism because it's a disadvantage to survival, or a mutation gets in there that helps, like light or developing a little lens that will become an eye. Things like that. Slowly, 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 ever so slowly, at a pace we are just too slow to understand because it takes millions and millions and millions of years. Eventually, we get reptiles. Large animals would take a long time to evolve, but we do know that about 400 million years ago, they were coming out of the water too. One of the first earliest reptiles that crawled out of the ocean and developed legs that were actually positioned underneath them, rather than to the sides, which were better for swimming but not for supporting weight on land, start to evolve. From there, some developed cold-blooded tendencies and others began to develop hair. About 256 million years ago, shortly after the appearance of the first reptiles, we have two branches that split off. One branch is the Cercopsids, which are what modern birds and reptiles come from. And the other branch is the Synapsida, which are where modern mammals come from. Both of them had a pair of holes in the skulls behind the eyes, which were used to increase the space for jaw muscles. Synapsids had one opening on each side, while diapsids had two. And the earliest mammal-like reptiles are the pechlosaurs. The pechlosaurs were the first animals to have a temporal fenestrae. And of course, the Therapsida were the direct ancestors of mammals. Nobody is sure why hair begins to develop on warm-blooded mammals, though the most common idea is that it was insulation against cold seasons. And later it's speculated that early humans lost their fur coats to keep cool while hunting for food around the equator. As these thousands of species of animals were branching off from the first single-celled bacteria, the threat of predators and prey becomes more and more relevant. Larger animals needed more energy to regulate body functions and had to evolve to get it from one source that other than the absorption of sunlight that just wasn't cutting it anymore. Animals began eating other animals, speeding up the process of natural selection. While early bacteria developed mutations that might help them do a job a little better at random, larger animals were now evolving traits specifically based on immediate threat of predators. Slow animals got eaten, so only fast genes were passed on, if that makes any sense. Some animals learned to climb to get out of harm's way. They evolved tails to balance, thumbs to grab branches, and dexterous feet to do the same. Now, Earth has seen at least five major extinction periods. The Ordovician, the Devonian, the Permian, the Triassic, and the Cretaceous, in that order. And we've had a lot of smaller ones. And we know that during the Permian extinction, about 245 million years ago, that 95% of all those animals that had evolved up into that time, 95% disappear from the known fossil record. They disappear. This was a huge extinction. Think about this for a minute. For over 200 million years, longer than humans have been around, the Earth hosted species and animals that far outlived any of us. And we will never know them or see them. They were here, they thrived, and they survived. And then they were gone. We like to think that we rule the world, but humans are really a blink of an eye in this history. Dr. Nadia Belinda Frobisch is a German biologist and paleontologist, and she documents how quickly some animals recovered from the Permian extinction. Her team discovered a 244 million year old fossil named the, and I know I'm going to botch this, Thalatoracon saurophagus, which means the lizard eating sovereign of the sea. And this fossil that Dr. Frobisch found was a complex predator that rose around 8 million years after the Permian extinction. So it took 8 million years for something this complex to re-evolve or evolve out of this extinction, out of what was left. This ithacosaur was found in what is today's known as the Favorit Canyon in the Augusta Mountains in Nevada. And most of the creature was preserved, including the skull and parts of the fins and the complete vertebral column of the tip of the tail. It was part of a group of marine reptiles that lived at the same time as the dinosaurs and roamed the oceans for 160 million years. It's about 28 feet long and has a massive skull and has just this huge skull full of large, sharp cutting teeth, used to seize and slice through any marine reptiles in the Triassic seas. It was what they call a meta-predator, and it was capable of feeding on animals with bodies similar to the size of its own. It was comparable to the size of a modern orca whale. And somewhere along with this creature that Dr. Nadia Frobisch found is a common ancestor with us that was able to survive all of these deaths and all of these extinctions. Somewhere, a single cell multiplied, collided with more cells, and more, and more, and evolved, and evolved, and then developed proteins, and multiplied, and functioned, and mixed with alien DNA, and grew, and grew, and grew into you. As Bill Bryson says, quote, "If your two parents hadn't bonded just when they did, possibly to the second, possibly to the nanosecond, you wouldn't be here. And if their parents hadn't bonded in a precisely timely manner, you wouldn't be here either. And if their parents hadn't done likewise, and the parents before them, and so on, obviously and indefinitely, you wouldn't be here. Push backwards through time, and these ancestral debts begin to add up. Go back just 8 generations to about the time that Charles Darwin was born, and already there are over 250 people on whose timely couplings your existence depends. Continue further to the time of Shakespeare and the Mayflower Pilgrims, and you have no fewer than 16,384 ancestors earnestly exchanging genetic material in a way that would eventually and miraculously result in you. At 20 generations ago, the number of people procreating on your behalf has risen to 1,048,576. 5 generations before that, and there are no fewer than 33,554,432 men and women on whose devoted couplings your existence depends. Just 30 or so generations back, you'll hit over 1 billion ancestors. And although we don't like to think about it, we are here because of a lot of, are you ready for it? Incest. If we compare our genes with other humans, we are 99.9% the same. That is how we become a species. A lot of incest. Now, I'm not advocating for incest at all, but our species shows up about 85 million years ago. at least in its earliest form, primates. Primates were a group of small, nocturnal, and arboreal insect-eating mammals that began a speciation that would lead to primates and tree shrews and lemurs. One of the earliest form of primates had claws and eyes located on each side of the head, and because of this, they were faster on the ground than on the top of the trees, and they began to spend long times on lower branches of trees, feeding on the fruits and leaves, just because of where their eyes were placed. This is one mutation that brought them lower, down lower from the trees. Another species of primates had grasping digits, but no forward-facing eyes, so it helped it grab onto things easier. By 63 million years ago, primates start to diverge into suborders. There was the Strepsirrhini, which were the wet-nosed primates, and the Haplorrhini, which were dry-nosed primates. The Strepsirrhini contain most of the prosimians, which are modern, which we know as lemurs and lorises. And the Haplorrhinis include three living groups, simian monkeys, apes, and tarsiers. One of these, Haplorrhini, lost its ability to metabolize to make its own vitamin C. This means that it and all of its descendants had to include fruit in its diet, where vitamin C could be obtained externally in order for it to survive. By 25 million years ago, the Catarrhini split into two superfamilies, old world monkeys, that's a word I can say, and apes. Our trichromatic color vision has genetic origins in this period. This is where we start to see color. Now, the old world monkey produce offspring that have features including thin tooth enamel, a light build with a narrow chest and short forelimbs. And its ape-like features were still the lack of a tail, these ape-like elbows, and a slightly larger brain relatively to body size. By about 13 million years ago, hominid ancestors speciate from the ancestors of the orangutan. Some of these hominid are considered the common ancestors of humans and other great apes, or at the very least, a species that brings us to a closer common ancestor than any previous fossil discovery. This ancestor, this common ancestor, is believed to have had special adaptations for tree climbing, as do present-day humans and other great apes. It had a wide, flat rib cage, a stiff lower spine, flexible wrists and shoulder blades that lay along its back. About 7 million years ago, the Hominima, which was a subtribe of the Hominini, who are closely related to the first ancestors of humans, speciated from the ancestors of chimpanzees. Both chimpanzees and humans have a larynx, and this repositions during the first 2 years of life to a spot where the pharynx and the lungs are located, indicating that our common ancestor would have this feature. This is what gives us the ability to speak. All of these mutations multiply and divide and thrive or die out, and this is where we're left. The first human-like footprints show up on the historical record about 4 million years ago. That is such a small blink of time. When you consider that some of the fossils, like Dr. Frobisch has found, lived in the seas for 160 million years ago, the first human-like footprints show up about 4 million years ago. A member of the Australopithecus afarensis left human-like footprints on volcanic ash in Laetoli, Kenya, which is northern Tanzania. It provides a strong evidence for full-time bipedalism. We believe from these footprints that this is where we see primates starting to spend a lot of time on the ground. This Australopithecus lived between 3.9 and 2.9 million years ago and is considered one of the earliest hominins, the species that developed and comprised a lineage of Homo and Homo's closest relatives after the split of the line of the chimpanzees. These are our distant, distant ancestors. They had reduced canine molars, and they were relatively larger than modern humans. They also had a really small brain, and they had a projecting anterior face, not to the sides. Fossils from this group were found in savanna environments, probably for scavenging opportunities. They developed into their diet to include meat. Analysis of the Australopithecus africanus lower vertebrae suggests that these bones began to change into females to support bipedalism even during pregnancy. So, single cells collect each other, they get a mutation, the mutation helps. For millions and millions of years, they're bumping around in the sea till something evolves where they can survive outside of the sea. They do what they do. They start to spread onto the earth. They build and build and build. They survive and they thrive. And then the world changes and there's extinctions and the planet is developing and changing. A lot of creatures die out and they don't have the mutations or the adaptability to protect them, but some do. And they multiply, and they mate, and they build, and they build, and they build, and they survive. And they slowly develop into Homo sapiens. And that is where we're going to leave it today. We did a lot of the long and complicated and fascinating groundwork that gets us to the beginning of where we get to tell the stories of women. So I'm so excited for you to listen to next episode. Thanks. This episode you just listened to is produced by Lindsay Hanson Park, co-produced by Grace Bull, who also contributed to some of the writing. The music was provided by this great band, Lady Murasaki, and you can check them out at ladymurasaki.bandcamp.com. If you like what you hear, check out more podcasts at storyofwoman.org, where there's a link to other podcasts that I have done.